Working Cows Podcast, episode 223.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Conry, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And this episode is brought to you by Xyway brand fungicides from FMC.
Go long for season-long foliar disease protection that starts at plant. Only Xyway brand fungicides from FMC provide season-long foliar disease protection from the start. Active ingredient flutriafol moves through your corn plants as they grow for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. Growers and retailers are sharing their Xyway brand fungicide success stories at xyway.ag.fmc.com. Always read and follow all label directions.
Today on the Working Cows Podcast, very excited to be joined by Bob McBride of McBride Bucking Bulls, and we are going to talk to him about the business of bucking bulls. What is that? What does that take? I mean, this is a related enterprise, maybe a way to add value on your operation to take on this this value added segment, or to pursue this value added enterprise. So, but there's a lot that goes into it, and a lot that I think many people, including myself, as even a lifelong consumer of rodeo and sometimes participant in different rodeo events, didn't understand about the bucking bull industry. And so I got in touch with Bob McBride and said, hey, let's talk about the business of bucking bulls. So that's what we're going to do here today on the Working Cows Podcast. Bob, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we connected after a ranching for profit RFP online webinar, and we got to talking about your business and what you guys are doing there. And so can you tell me a little bit about the business of McBride Bucking Bulls?
Sure. Well, we've been in the bucking bull business just a little over 20 years now. The industry would call it a born to buck program. So we're not stock contractors. We don't produce rodeos or bull ridings, but we have a registered cow herd that that we raise bucking bull calves out of, and then develop those bulls and, you know, sell them as competition and or future bucking bull prospects. So you know, there's a number of different segments, you know, in the industry, but I guess you could put us in the cow calf bucket, so to speak.
Gotcha. And yeah, so the born to buck is just the cow calf version within the buck and bull business.
Correct.
Gotcha. And so I guess I look at this as a kind of an interesting and maybe a little bit out of the box way to add value to a cow herd. Is that, I suppose there's more to it than that, but is that kind of how that happened?
Well, that is the objective. I mean, at the scale that we operate, you know, we want to produce a premium product. So, you know, a lot of the folks that you would interview in your podcast, you know, they, rather than selling calves at the stockyards, you know, a lot of your listeners and some of your guests, you know, carry them and finish them and then sell steaks, you know, to people right off their farm and ranches. So I would parallel it to that. I mean, we want to produce a premium product. I mean, we have overhead costs that we're carrying across, so to speak, you know, 50 head of rodeo cows and not 1,000 beef cows. So, you know, in order to, you know, have a sustainable and viable business, I mean, we want to market a valuable product at day's end. So that's easier said than done, because, you know, not every bull calf born is a superstar, right? So the odds get higher as you, you know, develop your program and the genetics, et cetera, which we can, you know, talk about later. But it is a, you know, again, a superstar is not easy to come by. So, but that is the pursuit. That is our desire to, you know, create the very best Cavs we can. And you know, in hopes that, you know, one, it brings notoriety to our program. And, you know, two, that we can sell them for a price that allows us to do it again next year. So sure. That's the plan.
And can you tell me a little bit about where you are in the world?
Sure. I live in South Central Kansas, a short hour south and east of Wichita, Kansas. So we're on the south and western edge of the Flint Hills. I can be in Oklahoma in about 30 minutes straight south. We're in a native pasture, you know, big time yearling country, you know, for summer grazing. Where we live is there's some farm ground around us, you know, some of the river bottom areas, you know, been broke out, but most of the area right around us is grass, which I like. So,
yeah, me too. So I think in a lot of these plains states, I hear this statistic that every 50 miles you go east, because really, if you look at it, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, really, they all kind of share that extreme western border is about the same as far as the longitude is concerned. And so then really their eastern border isn't far off either. So I hear this statistic that basically every 50 miles you go east is worth another inch of rainfall. Would that hold true in Kansas in your understanding?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty close. I mean, we're about a 34 or 36 inch annual rainfall here. And yes, we have some cows, beef cows that we keep in Missouri. You know, I would say that, gosh, I don't know now, it's 160, 70 miles, you know, or better over there. And they certainly have, I'd say they have 10 inches at least or better on us, you know.
So I guess the way the mindset I have about ranching is that it's kind of a land of opportunity. Like there are so much diversity in the ranching industry that you can. My apologies to Pete Farrell for using the word industry, but there's so much diversity within the ranching industry that you can use. Or you can do about whatever you want, really. I mean, you could be a stocker person, you could be a cow-calf guy, you can be a seed stock guy, you can, you know, and then that's just within the paradigm, and then you can get way outside the paradigm and do other kind of wild things and still call it ranching. And then I think to pair that with the ranching for profit mindset and world would be to say what kind of really trips your trigger, what adds value in your life, what makes you happy, what part of this industry do you enjoy the most? And given our previous conversations, for you, I would say that's raising quality bucking bulls. Is that kind of what drew you into this business? Is it just that you enjoy it?
You know, when I was a kid, I rode bulls. So, you know, a lot of the early day folks in the bucking bull business, you know, would be bull riders. You know, today it's evolved and we have people from all walks of life that are involved in the industry, you know, today. But, you know, I would say that the lion's share early on were, you know, kind of guys that grew up around rodeo, lots of guys that rode bulls when they were young and, you know, want to continue that, you know, that in some form or fashion. So, you know, they raise bulls or become, you know, bull guys, bull trainers, stock contractors, et cetera. But I like genetics. I like to breed animals. That is just always something that has interested me. And I was thankful that, you know, when I was in college and dreaming about, you know, what I would do one day, you know, with cattle, the buck and bull business, started to evolve in a more, out front way. There's always been, you know, for decades and decades, I mean, there was guys that raised bulls, raised bucking bulls, but it was, you know, a very small group, right? And in the late 90s, a fellow by the name of Bob Tallman, who's, you know, one of the, arguably the, you know, the, one of the greatest rodeo announcers that, you know, ever picked up a microphone. But Bob Tallman, he was interested in bull genetics and, you know, mainstreamed it, so to speak. When I was in college, when I was finishing up college, the late 90s was the first time ever that some of the top bucking bulls in the nation at the time appeared in a in Genetic Horizons stud catalog, you know, where they were standing these bull stud and marketing the semen on them. And I would say that, you know, never before that time had that happened. I believe that, you know, that it would have been kind of around 97 or something like that, where those bulls, you know, were promoted in, you know, a mainline, you know, seed stock, semen directory. And I got to thinking, gosh, this is for real. You know, I could take those bulls and made them to beef cows at the time is what I thought, crossbred beef cows, and, you know, create bucking bulls. And so that, you know, that excited me and I couldn't wait to dive into it and did just as quickly as I could out of college. But yeah, I've always been interested in the genetics and it's a tough game. So I think the challenge is, keeps my attention and it's not easy. And so, it's extra rewarding when you win. I've enjoyed it. It's certainly been tough at times, over the years, but continue to have a passion for it. And of course the industry continues to grow. So that's exciting. And so the trajectory, you know, of the business is better than it's ever been.
So what is it that makes a good bucking bull? I guess I'll leave it there. I have a bad habit of asking six questions at one time. So what is it that makes a good bucking bull?
A bull doesn't necessarily have to have a pedigree, but the odds go up when they do. And I think some of the qualities you'll find in some of the best bulls, and of course there's always an objection, you know, to every rule, but I think you'll see that a lot of the great bulls have a good mind. People have always asked me when we've got to talking about the bucking bull business, typically folks that, you know, don't know it, maybe not even involved in the ag industry in any form or fashion, but just, you know, compelled by what I do here on a ranch. And, you know, they always think that the bucking bull is just terribly mean and that's what makes them good. And some are, but I would say that most of the greats aren't, or they're mean when they need to be. They know when to turn that switch on and off. And so, you know, the great bucking bulls last, and they last because they, of self-preservation. So, you know, they take care of themselves. And so they're not, you know, they're not, wild with every motion, right? They handle decent. Again, I'm talking about most of the greats. I think that would be the common thread you'd find. And they've got a good mind. And when the shoot gate cracks, that's when they turn it on. Mm. And a lot of the great bulls, have a lot of a feel to them. And by that, I mean, they can feel a cowboy. They know when they feel a weight shift and they'll move away from it. So, you know, a lot of the great bulls, why, you know, most of them have sort of a pattern, a set pattern that they buck and will sort of do the same thing most of the time. But the greats have the ability to change it up when they feel something different. If they feel like they're getting rode, they'll do something different, change it up, spin the the opposite direction or do something different. And I think a good mind, being smart, I think is a common thread you'll see in the very, you know, best of the best bucking bulls. Of course, there is a criteria, you know, that they're judged on. And so in the buck and bull competition game, those bulls are judged on like five different categories. So one is buck, one is
what's
kick.
The measurement of buck?
So buck would be like rare and height.
How high the front legs are, and then how high they get overall.
Correct. Yep. On the front, and then the kick is the rear. So, you know, how much extension do they kick through? Do they just kind of kick, you know, with half effort? Are they kicking at their belly? Are they kicking up and kicking through? And so you'll hear, like in the industry, they'll say, you know, a bull kicking through themselves. So, I mean, that's the fullest extension of the back legs and just getting steep, right? And then spin is the other criteria. So, you know, the judges today and the bulls that they like, I mean, they want to see them bulls turn back. We don't want to see a bull, you know, hit the far side of the arena and, you know, bounce off and be halfway back before the whistle blows. They want them to stay close. And when they stay close, you know, they're spinning. Maybe it's tight and fast. Maybe it's, you know, what we'd call boxy, you know, where they're not, they're coming around, but, you know, kind of getting ahead and then coming around and, you know, moving forward and coming around. Some bulls will drift. Excuse me. And drift would be like spin with a fade to it, where they sort of, you know, they're spinning, but not like a top in one spot. You know, they're kind of moving out or fading out, drifting out. So, you know, there's different types of spin, but spin is one of the criteria. And then, you know, degree of difficulty. So, you know, that's one of the criteria. So whether a young bull in the buck and bull competitions, whether that bull's bucking under a dummy, or he's an older bull and he's bucking under a man, even if he's under a dummy, the judge is looking at, if there was a man on his back, you know, what's the degree of difficulty? You know, is he doing something different? Did he change it up? Like I mentioned earlier, if he's not getting rid of the rider, turning back left or the dummy, you know, he changes it up and turns back the other way. So, you know, changes the degree of difficulty, or maybe he's got a big belly roll, or does something, extra wild, so to speak. And then the last one is intensity. So how hard they're trying, right? Some bulls will just go through the motions, and some bulls mean it, right? And you can see that even an untrained eye, you know, can see levels of intensity. You know, just how hard is that bull trying to throw that guy off or throw that dummy off? So,
yeah, very good. You know, I think at one time in my life, I don't know what my streak was, but I caught almost every one of the UFC pay-per-views, and they always talk about the judging criteria on there. And, one of the judging criteria on there is aggression. And so, you know, kind of going back to that mean when they need to be, or turning it on at the right time. And then I think when you were talking, it brought up, you know, the idea that, you know, if they feel that bull rider get out of position, they might start their turn a little differently to keep making him out of position. And then you hear bull riders then talk about, you know, I just couldn't catch up. I got behind, and then I never caught up, and he ended up, you know, launching me or whatever. So I think if people haven't been around rodeo, you know, maybe some of those things are new to them, but that's kind of how you see that play out, I think. Is, would you agree?
Yeah, I do. And it's funny you mentioned UFC, and, you know, mixed martial arts is one of my favorite sports. I mean, I just love the UFC, and I've compared bulls to fighters, you know, many, many times for years, when I've met people that are interested and have no understanding, you know, haven't been around rodeo, haven't been around, you know, large farm animals or anything. And I say, you know, when they're asking about how mean these bulls are, and I've always drawn a comparison to these fighters. And so, you know, if a fighter goes into the octagon and he's just wild mad, and just goes to swinging, you know, recklessly and crazy, he's not typically the guy that's going to win, right? The guy that slows his motor down and picks his shots and has some acumen and, you know, takes his time and does it deliberately, you know, he'll pick that wild child off day and night, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the buck and bulls are the same way. I mean, I think a lot of those bulls that have trouble slowing their motor down, often are the bulls that wind up hurting themselves before they've realized their full potential. You know, we've seen that often with those kind of bulls that just have trouble, you know, slowing that motor down enough. Now, you don't want it, you know, you don't want it in neutral, or, you know, you don't want it slowed way down, but there is a sweet spot, right? And knowing how to play it and not full throttle all the time is a key element.
Yeah. Yep. Very good. You know, and you mentioned them being gentle, when it isn't game time. And I think you're right. They do recognize, you know, this is work. You know, I'm walking down the alley. There's a shoot. I've got a flank strap on. This is a work day. But there's a guy that breeds bucking bulls. And I don't know anything about this bull that he brings, but that breeds bucking bulls in my neighborhood and is doing it at a reasonably high level, I think. And he has this, and I don't know the breeds, and we're going to get into that in just a minute, but I don't know the breeds, but he's got this, what looks to me like just a straight Brahma bull that he brings to this rodeo. I think they call it the special rodeo or something, but basically it's kids that participate in Special Olympics. They bring all these farm animals out, ranch animals out, and give them the opportunity to just interact with them. And they've got all kinds of games and things for them. And it's during the South Dakota High School Finals rodeo. And he brings this Brahma bull out, and he's a bucking bull breeder. So I'm assuming it's a bucking bull, sire of some kind or something. And he's got a ring in its nose, and it just stands there all day. And they put kids on him, you know, these kids that have different disabilities of different kinds, to put bulls on him, let him pet him, let him sit on him, you know, all those things. And he just is there every year and never had an issue, just fine. So kind of an interesting example, I guess.
Sure. Well, I've seen great bucking bulls, you know, be that way. And there's some that aren't, right? I don't want to say that, you know, all the greats are quiet and gentle, because there's certainly been some greats that aren't that way, right? And that's okay, right? You figure them out, and it's just like humans, you know, you just not everyone's cut out of the same mold, you know, even if you grew up in the same neighborhood. So it's, you know, they're all different. And so I don't want to, I'm not. It's, you cannot speak in absolutes, probably, right? In everything, but certainly not in the buck and bull business, because they'll make a liar out of you every time. But yep. I was going to tell you about a bull that he was the 3-time PBR buck and bull of the year, world champion bull, Sweet Pros Bruiser, an outstanding bull, and really bucked. And he you could pet him. I mean, he was plumb gentle. I had the opportunity to, I was visiting the ranch that bull was born on, and you know, where he was, they're stock contractors as well. So they raise bulls and carry them all the way to the PBR and the whole 9 yards. And so I was there looking at bulls, and I saw Bruiser at a pen, and I walked down to see him, and he met me at the fence, and not to hit me, but he wanted me to pet him. and I pet him. And I stepped away, and he turned around, he gave me his other side, you know, and put his other side against the fence, you know, so just a big pet, but double rank when it was kind of time to do work, you know?
Mm. Yeah. So. Do you remember a bull called Crystalix? No, he might've been from my neighborhood, but I remember, and man, this would have been probably in the mid-90s, and they would bring him to the Black Hills Roundup in Belfouche. And I'm pretty sure I remember it happening more than once where they, and I think it was a 4x4 they would put above his head when he was in the chute, and you could hear that thing from across the arena crack when he would hit it. He'd lift his head up and just snap it. And the guy I was sitting with, I remember him telling me this, it's kind of a showmanship deal from the stock contractor that this bull's, you know, big and tough or whatever. But yeah, I that's one specific bull memory that sticks out for me personally. I haven't been as deep into the business as you are. So maybe I'm speaking out of school or something, but
I've seen that, and particularly in years past, they would rear in the chute, mm-hmm. to the point that they might flip over.
right?
You know, just where they were kind of treacherous. They would slide a 4x4, you know, over their hump, you know, just, you know, past the, you know, past their head and kind of across their neck, just to, you know, just to keep them from coming over backwards on you.
Yep.
And, you know, they'd slide it out on their way out. Right. So,
right. Yep.
Yeah, you're right on.
Yeah. So what about breeds? And I guess I don't know the state by state breakdown of who listens to this podcast anymore. I used to have those statistics, but I don't, right now. But I know I do have a healthy audience in the South, especially Texas, but, other places South and East as well. So, but I'm in black hided cattle country, you know, and so I'm not exposed to, you know, the Brayfords and those kinds of things, but what are some of the breeds that have worked their way into, what are used as buck and bulls now?
I would say all of the Brahmin crossbreds that you could think of, right? So Brayford, Charbray, Simbra, I mean, you name them, what was it? The Brahmazine. I mean, you know, there was all sorts of, you know, combinations with the Brahmin, right? The old, you know, the great F1, the Hereford, Brahmin cross, first cross. So, I mean, you would find all of them, in the American Buck and Bull. So, the American Buck and Bull is a breed today. It's a breed made up. I mean, it's truly a Heinz 57, right? I mean, you would find Longhorns, Watusis. There's one of the early day lines of Buck and Bulls was developed by two gentlemen, a guy named Tom Harlan and Charlie Plummer. And the Plummer line held that name. So they called, you know, Plummer Bulls. And those Plummers had white park in them. So you'll see a lot of the Plummer genetics will have that, you know, black ears, black nose, you know, white hided, and then just, you know, black points like the old white parks. And so, of course, I've seen some Longhorn cattle, you know, colored that way. So, truly a Heinz 57. And in the last, you know, 20 years, you know, the registry or the association has started to, you know, aggregate the genetics. So today, I mean, you wouldn't find a heaping handful of any of those breeds that I just talked about, right? I mean, those individual cattle are so diluted now, that, you know, truly the American Buck and Bull today is really a Heinz 57 of, you know, just great, great bulls, and the daughters and granddaughters and great daughters buy them. Right. So, you know, this is a fun fact for me, and I just learned it this week, and I've been in the buck and bull business for, you know, over 20 years. The first year that the American Buck and Bull Incorporated, which is the registry and the association, the first year it started, I became a member. And so, you know, I've been around this thing for, you know, since the beginning, so to speak. And I had no idea, and just learned this week, I heard the president of the ABBI state that our registry is the third largest cattle registry in the nation. I would have never guessed that, right? You talked about you live in black-hided country. I think everyone lives in black-hided country. I don't care where you're at. I mean, you know, those black cattle, you know, rule the day. They've done a great job with marketing, and mm-hmm. you know, the industry demands them, right? And so, you know, of course, most of those cows you and I see are commercial cows. So I would imagine, I don't know what the other two breeds are. I would imagine that Angus is, you know, probably one or two, but mm-hmm. I had no idea that registry, we're the third largest cattle registry in the nation. So over 300,000 cattle are in the registry. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I would guess It would be probably Angus and then maybe Holstein, just given the number of milk cows in this country.
But yeah, could be. I don't know. But I wouldn't have guessed we're in the top 10.
Right. You know? Yeah. And I bring up Holsteins. I think it's pretty common knowledge or people I've heard it said that all the Holstein cows in America basically go back to two sires at this point. And it kind of sounds like the American bucking bull is the opposite of that. It's everything mixed together, and then kind of they found a recipe that worked pretty well, and they started to use bulls that were similar and started to just kind of select for those traits, and they all kind of now look pretty similar, really. I mean, there's a lot of different color, but it's a lot of brindle, a lot of big horns on them that are kind of shaped the same way, and some of those things.
We've seen some programs that have had great success, and a lot of people have gone to those programs for genetics. So we're starting to see more close relations, so to speak, or at least pools, right, of genetics. We're seeing that, you know, getting dialed in a little bit tighter than it would have been, say, a decade ago. But still, I would agree with your summary. It's still A to Z. There isn't two or three or 10 sires that, you know, the whole gene pool goes back to, like you would find in, you know, so many of the good, you know, traditional beef breeds, right? But I do want to mention, while we're talking about the registry, that what I think is unique, and I'm just from my limited, time spent around other associations and that, but our registry, we have to prove the DNA. So it's not by the honor system. So when I send my registration papers or my registration request, I should say, to enter a bull or a heifer into the registry, I can't just tell them what the sire and dam is. I have to send a DNA sample. And so that's done either by blood or tail hair samples. And the registry, the ABBI, they then verify what I'm telling them is fact. And so when I get a set of registration papers on an animal, the sire and dam have been proved by DNA. So I think that's unique. I know with the cow dogs I raise, I mean, I can just tell the registry who the dad is and who the mother is, and, you know, away we go. And I know in some other beef cattle breeds, you can do that as well. I suspect probably in horses. I don't know that as fact, so maybe I'd have tread lightly. But I've always thought that was a great thing that the ABBI, you know, has done to purify, the product, so to speak. I mean, it is absolutely verified, and so. So yeah, I mean, we can speak in absolutes when it comes to genetics, right?
Yep. And as a just a side note, are those black mouth yellow curs that you're raising?
Yeah, that's them.
Yeah, I was creeping on your Facebook page and I saw some.
That's okay.
Well, yeah, I was looking for the picture. You had a picture of a bull that, I mean, his heels were straight above his head, and I was looking for that picture for extension. An example of extension, but
it's kick, I guess.
But
if you don't find it, I'll send you another one.
All right, sounds good. Just to clarify, or to make sure I got this right for my own history, Bodacious was straight Charolais, right?
I would call him a Charbray.
Charbray, okay. He looked straight Charolais to me, but I have very untrained eyes.
Yeah, he definitely would have had a little Brahmin influence.
Gotcha.
I did see him in the flesh.
Okay.
When I was a kid, but you'll find him in. I mean, he never turned out to be, you know, the greatest sire of bulls, but you'll find that his daughters, granddaughters, great granddaughters, etc. A lot of producing cows, in the registry will go back to Bodacious. So, you know, it's interesting what some sires will do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. So, you know, this is the Working Cows podcast. We're talking about business, the business side of this. So I don't want to leave that aside, but I do want to talk a little bit more about training or what the life cycle of one of these bulls looks like, you know, from birth through maybe appearance in a rodeo that somebody might have heard of. How sure. What does that look like?
Well, we can start training these bulls when they're a year old. So training would look like this. You know, we start to put a handle on them, you know, getting them used to being, you know, handled on the ground, you know, going through a gate, you know, being handled in the back pens, you know, and you know, going up lead ups into the buck and shoot, what we call shoot etiquette, you know, standing in the shoot and not, you know, not thrashing too terribly bad or flipping over or laying down, you know, just getting them used to, hey, the shoot's not here to hurt you. And then as a yearling animal, we'll buck those bulls under a dummy. And the dummy is just a metal box. You know, they're from, I don't know, 6 to 15 pounds, depending on the size you get. But it's a metal box that cinches on with a saddle cinch. It has sort of a seatbelt type release, sort of like you'd have in your car. And we have a remote control or a remote switch that we can push the button and it'll release that seatbelt, so to speak, and allow the bull to buck that dummy off. And so that dummy is just there for weight to simulate sort of a rider. There's no legs or anything. It's just, like I said, it's just cinched on with like a saddle cinch and latigos. Sits in the middle of their back, just like a rider would. And then we have a flank strap, and the flank strap is just a cotton rope with an O-ring, typically an O-ring on one end. And we just tie that flank around the flanks of the bull. Why we're talking about the flank, people always ask about it. That flank does not go around the testicles of the bull. It's simply a belt, right? I mean, it's around their flanks, just like a belt is around your waist, right? But bulls don't wear belts, so they don't like it. They want it gone. It is there to promote them to kick through, like I mentioned earlier, kicking through to extend because they want that flank off of them, right? It's not natural to them. It doesn't hurt them. It's not hocked in them. It's not tight. All bulls are different, so the trainers figure out the nuances. Some bulls buck really good with it, you know, hanging on there. Some needs to be a little bit snugger, but it's not causing pain in any way. There's no barbs. There's no electric filaments in it. Any of these things that, you know, you've heard on the street from the, you know, less informed people that, you know, think that, you know, they're hurting animals at rodeo. This thing does not hurt them at all. Doesn't leave a mark, right? So it's tied on. We have a flank pin and a tether where the flank through the pin and the tether is tied to the dummy. So it's like so when we buck the dummy off, it pulls the pin and the pin is through the knot on the flank. So it drops the flank and the dummy. So everything is bucked off. So it's like a pressure and release, right? On like you hear people that train horses or dogs, you know. When we're training a young bull, when he does something special, you know, really tries hard, we release the dummy, right?
So even if it's prior to 6 or 8 seconds?
Correct. Mm. Yeah.
Cool.
So, and it, in the training pen, it could be 1 second, it could be two, right? Mm-hmm. If the bull really doesn't do something, you might leave it on longer to try to see, hey, you're going to try harder to get this thing off. It's up to the trainer's discretion, right? So, but it's seconds, right? And the dummy's off. And like I said, everything strips. So we're doing that at a year, right? And that bull will buck under a dummy clear through his two-year-old year, right? So in the buck and bull business, we have the ABBI, the registry that I talked about. In addition to being the animal or the breed registry, they also administrate all of the buck and bull competitions, the sanctioned competitions for the ABBI. So we have yearling classes where they buck these yearling bulls in competition as yearlings. And then we have the two-year-old, which we call the futurity system. And those are competitions where the bulls are bucked under the dummy. And the dummy in the competitions rides the bull for 4 seconds, right? So it's just a 4 second, trip mm-hmm. under the dummy. And again, that's at year one and two. A bucking bull doesn't have the physical size. Most, there are some exceptions, right? But most don't have the physical size to carry a man and not hurt themselves till they're about 3 years old, right? So at three, typically, is when you'll see these bulls, experience their first bull rider, right? And so in the ABBI and other associations that have buck and bull competitions, the three-year-old year we call the Derby. And then at a four-year-old, we call that the classic competition. So that's 3 and 4 year old competitions where those bulls are bucked under a cowboy. And that guy can ride them for 8 seconds, or ride them for half a second, right? And the bull is judged on his performance on that five-piece criteria that I laid out for you earlier. So then as a four-year-old, the ABBI, should mention is partly owned by the PBR. The PBR is the Professional Bull Riders. It is the NFL of professional bull riding, the NBA. I mean, it is the top of the food chain of bull riding, right? So the PBR is involved with the ABBI, both in ownership and in the competition piece. So these 3 and 4 year old competitions, often some of those events throughout the year are laid in alongside of a PBR competition, right? A PBR event, with the top bull riders in the world, that are in the PBR. And then the finals, the ABBI Derby and Classic Finals, is held during the PBR World Finals in Las Vegas every year. So they're running together. So that's sort of the competition, life cycle. Again, they can buck as a yearling, 2 year old futurity, 3 year old derby, 4 year old classic. After that, they enter the real world, so to speak, where they're either, if they're great, they could be at the PBR, they could be a PRCA pro rodeo type bull on some stock contractor's truck, or they could be, on some amateur string, somewhere,
So is there attrition then all the way along, or is there some level where this bull might be a late bloomer and he might actually show his true colors and his real ability in the Derby or the Classic? Or is there some bulls that they take them to the futurity, they take them to the next step, and then, well, this isn't really going to work out. We're going to go a different direction. He's going to go work for McDonald's or whatever.
Bulls won't buck really at a high level under a dummy, but they'll show you some tools, right? They'll leave some clues and some evidence that, hey, they're really not, doing everything you'd want them to do under a dummy, but it looks like if we let them grow up, they will be what we call rider bull. And so, there's lots of great bucking bulls that, weren't very, just weren't that impressive under a dummy. Now they weren't, it's not night and day. I mean, a bull that runs off under a dummy is probably not going to be a superstar when he's three, right? But if he just doesn't have all the tools, just, the most perfect out under a dummy, but he's got a lot of kick, maybe he's got some intensity, maybe he's not spinning under the dummy, but really kicking and getting in the air and trying hard. And, you let him grow up, you put a rider on him, and, you get a cowboy with legs and a full body, instead of a, 15 pound dummy, you've got a whole torso standing up over the back of your head, that's a lot more stimulation, right? And so, You know, there's lots of those bulls that will be much better performers when they're allowed to get older, right? Mm. But yeah, throughout the process, there's always a, you know, you're always sorting. I mean, there's always a cut, right? Yeah. So, hey, he's just not going to make it. So, you know, those bulls just get salvaged out. So go to the sale barn, and if they're young enough, somebody makes a steer out of them and, you know, grazes them.
Yep.
So
I want, and I know we're well into this discussion now, but I do want to turn to the business side of it. And, let me give you the rundown as I understand it. And if I missed anybody, let me know. And then I'll ask a follow-up question. But so we've got breeders like yourself, people who are raising stock to go on to become bucking bulls. And then you've got trainers and you've got stock contractors. Who am I missing in the business side of this industry?
Well, you'll have, I'd say there's a couple tiers of trainers, right? So you'll have guys that will, maybe they don't have cows, but they'll buy young bulls and grow them up and start to train them, you know, at a B level, so to speak. And then you have trainers that train bulls for a living, that's what they do. And they're hauling bulls to competitions week in and week out. And, those guys may be training the very top end, right? And there might be a B league, so to speak, trainer that's kind of vetting the bulls from, you know, unbucked to letting the cream rise to the top. And then maybe those bulls on the top end go to to a more elite trainer. So again, it's all the trainer bucket, but there's certainly guys that got a little better skill sets than others, right? So
okay, so let me lay it out and see if this is how it plays out. You're the breeder, so to speak. You're the guy raising calves to be perform as bucking bulls. And then is your customer a trainer? The guy that's buying the bull from you, is he a trainer, or how does that work?
Could be. So the other piece would just be investors, absentee investors that have an interest in the bucking bull industry, maybe PBR fans want to own a bull. And, you know, you've got people that, live in a subdivision somewhere and have ownership of bulls and keep them with, you know, a trainer.
Right. And they get together with their friends in the subdivision and watch their bull buck on TV.
So there are a number of those folks in the industry now. My target could be both the trainer, it could be absentee. Our first order of business is to sell a calf that could enter the futurity system, right? They can compete as a yearling and 2-year-old. That's what we're looking for right away. And then we're going to market that calf to somebody that wants to own that futurity calf. Now, whether that's a trainer or that's a trainer that's training bulls for half a dozen different, investors, some that maybe have cattle, or some that live in a subdivision, like I mentioned. But so we're going to market those cattle to those players, people that want to compete in that futurity game, bucking those calves under a dummy as a yearling and a 2-year-old. So that's our target. The bulls that look like they're going to mature, be later bloomers, you know, that we've got to carry to rider age, before, they'll probably realize their full potential. We're looking at that point. We're looking for maybe a stock contractor type, that has some country. They can turn these bulls out and let them grow for another year and a half. And then, see if they can develop them as a bucking bull, either for a competition or just as a using bull, And so, maybe that guy is a stock contractor himself, and he's got some country to turn them bulls out and, take them off the shelf at a later date. Or maybe it's somebody that's sort of like a grower, so to speak, that would turn those bulls out, go through them, when they're three, and then remarket them to stock contractor type folks, right? So there's a number of different, you know, ways you can, you know, play the game. So
sure. It sounds like your marketing venue is a cell phone, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm wondering, does it ever happen where you load up a trailer load of calves or whatever they would be at that point, short yearlings, or and take them to a competition and they get bucked out under a dummy and then they're sold based on their performance there? Does that happen at all in the industry?
Well, it has happened, but not so much anymore. There has been breeders that have had competitions or have bucked bulls at an event and then marketed them after, you know, either after that trip immediately or, you know, maybe later that night. But I would say that, you know, there isn't really a today. I don't want to criticize the ABBI in any way because they've done just tremendous work for the industry. But if there was something on my wish list, I would like to see the ABBI create some sort of, now they do have an annual sale, sort of an elite sale at Vegas during the World Finals, but it would be nice if we had some sort of sanctioned type of, you know, sale where we could buck bulls, where, you know, where it was a marketing tool. I mean, right. It was not a competition, but hey, if you want to consign your bull and carry it to this place, we're going to buck these bulls and we're going to market it and we're going to have buyers in the stands and, you know, we're going to sell these bulls after we buck them. I think that would be a real blessing to the industry if we could put our heads together and put something like that together. I would say most of the bulls today by the majority of the breeders are marketed a lot through social media by video. So a lot of your bull raisers like myself have an arena, you know, our own arena on the ranch, so we can buck these bulls at our house. And, you know, of course, everyone's got a tablet or an iPhone or a iPad or something nowadays. So we video those bulls and then, you know, post them on social media and in our world, so to speak. And, you know, people see these videos and they're buying prospects to maybe go compete with next year or this year, depending on, you know, what the play is. But I would say that, you know, the lion's share among most of the breeders, they're marketed online via video of the bulls bucking. So there are some breeders that will sell their whole calf crop unbucked, you know, guaranteed unbucked. Used to see a little more of that in years past, but, you know, I think today, you know, most of these bulls are gone through and then sold after you can lay eyes on them and see what they get done. So
sure.
The great ones are so valuable, you know, today that I think everyone just wants to see what they have.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And we've been going a while, but this is a fascinating conversation to me. So if you got some time, I'd keep going for a
minute. I have time. I hope I'm not off in the weeds too much. So, yeah.
No, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it. So, I mean, the reason I asked that question is because that is like, I think it's pretty common. I remember my brother going to buck and horse sales in college. And then they have the Miles City buck and horse sale every year in Miles City, Montana. So I think it happens pretty regularly.
So I'm sort of, and you're right. And I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I want to be clear to everybody. And so I'm sort of looking through a lens of again, the Born to Buck program, and I'm going to market a yearling or a long yearling calf, right? So that's sort of the lens I'm looking through. But you're right. There are bucking stock sales. You know, one of the biggest is Binion's bucking stock sale that's held every year during the National Finals Rodeo. And so, you know, these would be, you know, full grown, ready to haul bucking bulls and bucking horses that are bucked under riders. There's a competition, you know, so that's just like a, you know, a rodeo event. So the bull riders are competing,
right?
And the bronc riders and bareback riders are competing, and just so happens that after they ride or get thrown off their animal, an auctioneer cries a bid and it's sold, right? So, so Binion's big sale. You mentioned Miles City Buck and Horse sale, same. You've got the Joe Simon sale that's during the IFR, which is the International Finals Rodeo in Oklahoma City. And so they have a two-day buck and stock sale. There's also a group that puts on the Texarkana buck and bull sale. That's gone on for decades, where they make a bull riding competition and then buck these bulls, and then they're sold immediately after their trip. So, I mean, as soon as they throw the guy off or the guy rides them, whichever, auctioneer cries the bid, sells them, and, you know, out the arena they go, and the next one goes, and, you know, and so, yes, there is a number of those opportunities, but those are for, you know, age bulls, and your target audience there is a stock contractor, period.
Right. Right? And so, by age bull, you're talking 3-4 at least, right?
Yeah, a bull that can carry a man. Yeah. And go on somebody's truck and go to a rodeo or a bull riding competition.
And if you don't want competition in this industry, you can answer just flat no to this question. But is there room in this industry for people interested to get into it and start playing the game?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned that the fact that I just learned this week that, you know, the ABBI is the third largest cattle registry in the nation, right? So, There are people moving into this thing, you know, sounds like, you know, at least by the small truckloads, you know, it's very compelling. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sky's the limit. You know, I mean, there's a lot of room for creativity in it, right? It's, you know, one, it's a fledgling industry in some regards, two, the gaming side of it, and, you know, the ability to win money and lots of it with these bulls creates opportunities for, you know, the guy that I mentioned in the subdivision, you know, right, so to speak. There's fractional share type ownership. So, hey, you know, I want to buy a big time bull, but I don't have 50,000. Well, but I have 5,000. So, you know, maybe you put together 10 guys, right? So there's all kinds of creative ways to market these cattle and participate in this world. And I think that's compelling. It's, you know, it's interesting. It's exciting. You can own a bull and watch him on TV, you know, and you can go to Las Vegas and watch him, you know, with your friends. I mean, it's a very interesting, deal. And it's very challenging because, like I said at the onset, you know, raising a superstar is a tall task. And so, I think it keeps people's attention. It's exciting. And I think, you know, it will do nothing but grow. And every year the purses get higher. So at the finals this year, back in November, the ABBI finals, they paid out almost $2 million. So, you know, that'll get people's attention. Right. So, and it makes the bulls valuable. And I think I heard them say that by spring of next year, so that'll be not even a full season, right? So our world finals is during the PBR world finals in Las Vegas in November every year. So I think they said in the futurity game only, the buck and bulls under a dummy, the yearling and futurity, I think their projection was that they would pay out like over $2 million by spring next year. So, you know, that's half the season, and that's just in one piece of the gaming industry. You know, that quote was not considering the 3 and 4 year old bulls, right? And so, I think this deal will continue to grow, and I think it'll grow with a lot of different types of owners, right? I don't know that. Well, I suspect you'll see some growth in the cow calf, as I call it, piece of it. Mm-hmm. But I think there's probably a little more blue sky in some of the absentee type ownership arrangements. Right. So,
yep. Is there a way that the buck and bull business can complement a beef cow calf business, or are they siloed?
No, I think they can. We have a cow calf operation, and, you know, most of the infrastructure is all the same, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, a cow's a cow. Now, I will say that the rodeo bred cattle, you know, the disposition on the cattle is a little bit different. You know, some of these cows are gentle and fine, but I think the Brahmin influence creates a little more intelligence, and hopefully I don't offend the Boss Taurus people, but you know, the Brahmin cattle have some intelligence, and these cattle can be a little more difficult to pen. They like a bucket of feed just like every other, but they're wise too. You know, a lot of them won't blindly just walk into a wheel corral and let you get around them. You know, they'll run in, grab a bite to eat and run out, you know? So it does the infrastructure. You know, I said that it's the same. Well, it is largely, but there's some nuanced pieces that, you know, maybe, you know, just to, some things that you would set up that would allow you to more easily handle cattle that have a little bit more of a wild side to them. You know, but other than that, I mean, they're a cow, and, you know, the bulls, we don't have any problem with the bulls. I mean, and by bulls, I mean the herd sires. I mean, they're, you know, by the time they're a man, most of them have, you know, settled down, and they, you know, they handle just like any other. Now, some of them will have a disposition, you know, problem, be a little bit hot, you know, maybe not like to be crowded so much. And, you know, some of them can be mean, but if you're game for that and you're willing to handle that, I mean, that's, you know, like I say, you could ranch these cattle just the same. And what's interesting, if you have an appetite for it and you're interested in it, the upside is great. I mean, you know, if you have a 600-pound steer, you know, black steer, and the market says he's worth $1.50 a pound today, you know, that's all you're going to get. I mean, if the stars align and he's got, you know, and he could go be grazed and somebody really needs one, he might bring a couple bucks, $100 more, right? But he's not going to bring $3,000, right? I mean, he's just, and with a buck and bull calf, you know, if he does it, you could sell him for $10, $20, $30, $50,000. I mean, that excites me, right? So,
yep. Is it a seed stock business essentially, in that the heifers go to other breeders and end up producing bull calves for bucking? Is that, because it's kind of the opposite of the beef business, in that you cut those steers and keep the heifers for replacements. You know, it's different anyways. It may not be the opposite, but where do the heifers end up?
Yeah, the heifers should end up in somebody's breeding program. If you're on purpose with your breeding and you're mating, you know, good cows to exceptional bulls, you know, every generation in terms of genetics should be a little bit stronger, right?
Right.
So I think the heifers have a tremendous amount of value. They should. They have this last year, the ABBI in the yearling buck and bull competitions allowed heifers to compete. And I think that's outstanding, because in any of the, you know, in the performance horse business or the racehorse business, you know, those fillies can run with the colts, right? So, and then those fillies that can run fast, you know, wind up being broodmares, and, you know, in hopes that she'll pass that speed on to her babies, right? And so I'm really excited that the ABBI has embraced the heifer. Of course, she only has 1 year to compete, because as a two-year-old, she ought to be having a calf, you know? So they just let her compete as a yearling. And this year, actually, I can't remember, the calf's name was Buttons, and in the yearling competition out in Vegas. And I can't remember, I think she won it. I think if she didn't win it, she was second. Wow. I wish I could tell you exactly, but I do remember her name was Buttons. And she was, I don't know, she's like 93 and some change or 94 points. I mean, she was very, I mean, rank. And so I think that adds value to the heifers that one, we can compete them. And then two, if they really have, you know, if they can really buck, then, you know, the probability, at least it's another move in the right direction. It's not absolute, but it's, you know, the probability goes up that if she bucks and you breed her to something that bucks, you know, you ought to be able to make something that bucks, right? I mean, it's just logical, right? So there's guys now that a lot of guys will buck their heifer calves just at home and then keep back the replacements of the ones that really buck, you know, and then the ones that don't, maybe they'll just take to the local stockyard and, you know, cash them out. But, I mean, I think there's value in both the male and female. Obviously the bulls, you know, there's a little more there, but the heifer in my mind is the holy grail, because she's eventually the factory. And what we found out in the buck and bull business, as other industries have found out, you'll find a pattern that these females that produce good bulls, they will continue to do so, and their daughters and granddaughters and so on and so forth will have a higher probability of doing the same. So, you know, it's the cow families that a guy wants to focus on in terms of athletics, you know, athleticism. And I don't think I'm wrong that the horse industry is the same way. You know, some of these mare lines, I mean, they, you know, you still need that good sire, but focusing on the females that do it and keeping back the daughters and granddaughters of those, I think is when you start really getting things dialed in.
We could go a long time here, Bob, but I guess, much to the chagrin of my teachers, I never ran out of questions, and actually am not out of good questions. I don't think I got two more for sure. And one of them we talked about already. And I said, you know, when we go to a rodeo, you know, sometimes, maybe often, my family has been known to get up and leave during the bull riding because not many bulls get rode anymore. And it seems like the performance of bulls has outpaced the performance of cowboys. Do you see that as maybe a situation where the bull breeders need to take the foot off the gas, or is it a situation where the cowboys just need to get better?
I think the cowboys need to get better. I wouldn't advocate the taking the foot off the pedal for the back or go back to, you know, what I was telling you in terms of the purse money and the trajectory for the, you know, the purse in bull competitions. I mean, that's going to do nothing but put more people on the path to try to create, you know, the next great superstar that's better than the one last year. So you know, I think the riders are going to have to, they're just going to have to, you know, come to the dance, because I don't think we're going to throttle it back. Or, you know, there's associations and other, you know, places somebody can compete that's not at the, you know, the top level, right? But, you know, look at the money though today in the PBR. You know, these top bull riders, when they retire, if they were smart with their money, they don't have to take a day job. They can continue to do what they love, you know, with maybe, you know, they're not going to ride bulls anymore, but maybe they'll ranch or do something, you know, that's similar and have the money to do it. I mean, these top bull riders retire millionaires. So, you know, that should be motivation on their end. I mean, you don't see the, a lot of these guys, I mean, certainly in the PBR again, I mean, these guys are athletes, and, you know, the top end of them guys have nutrition programs. They're in the gym. You know, they take this deal serious because, you know, they really, the earning potential while they're young and physically able is unlike it's ever been, you know, and literally when they get done, if they're an elite, they have enough money to, you know, maybe not sit on their laurels, but sure pick what they want to do, sure. You know, and not be forced into some sort of day job just to make ends meet.
Yep.
So.
And the Bulls can retire to become a stud, right? I mean, is that, yeah, would that? Absolutely. Well, good. And I guess my last question is, could you just tell me about the bull that you raised or that was born on your place that you're most proud of?
Sure. Yeah. The bull that I'm most proud of is a bull called Biker Bob. We raised him and I guess what I'm maybe equally proud of is we raised his mother and her mother.
Wow.
And I'd have to give it some thought. I may have raised her mother. So that really, you know, that really makes me proud. But Biker Bob was the national champion or world champion 3-year-old Derby bull in an association called the UBBI in 2016. So he was the world champ. As a 3-year-old, his 4-year-old year, he went on to PBR truck. Incidentally, Chad Berger, who is, you know, top many time stock contractor of the year and PBR 7, 8, 9 time, you know, stock contractor of the year. He owns him and owned him then. We actually sold Biker Bob to his son-in-law and he competed with him as a 3-year-old. Like I said, he won the world that year in the UBBI. And then Chad Berger put him on his PBR truck as a 4-year-old. And he went, you know, across the country everywhere. I mean, just right away. I think his first PBR was in Oklahoma City. And, you know, 2 weeks later, he was in California. And that bull just took it. No matter where they hauled him, he came to the show. And he went to the PBR World Finals 4 years and was a top bull. I mean, a featured kind of bull, not a long rounder. I mean, he would have been, you know, what we'd call a short round or, you know, a featured type top end bull, you know, all 4 years. And when they rode him, they, you know, win lots of money. I mean, it'd be 90 on him, you know, plus. And so he got hurt. And I should say also, so last year he was also selected to go to the National Finals Rodeo and he was injured. So he didn't get to go, but he was selected. So, you know, I was proud of that. And he since, you know, just that injury that, you know, kept him from going to the National Finals Rodeo last year, he just couldn't ever get over it. Chad tried to, you know, lay him off and then they'd crack him back out and he couldn't shake it. So, he's retired for good for now, but boy, we got to watch him on TV a lot of times. We got to watch, you know, watch guys win rounds on him, and just made us proud. And most people knew who he was, you know, PBR fans and that. And I've got a picture in my office where Jess Lockwood, the year he won, the last year that he won the PBR World Finals, he won a round on him. And a magazine out of Fort Worth, Texas called Humps and Horns, which is a bull riding publication. They had a picture of Jess and Biker Bob, you know, winning that round of the PBR finals on the front cover of their magazine the following month. And I've got that picture framed of the, you know, the front page of that magazine in my office. And so we're super proud of Biker Bob and proud of his sire, who we had for a number of years that, bull called Velvet Jacket. He was sired by Little Yellow Jacket that came from you know, that Chad Berger had and he was 3-time Buck and Bull of the Year in the PBR. And so Velvet Jacket, the sire of Biker Bob, was sired by Little Yellow Jacket. And he was out of a 018 Cowtown cow, and Cowtown was Buck and Bull of the Year in the PRCA back in the late 80s. And Cowtown came from where I came from in New Jersey. And so where I grew up on the East Coast, and, you know, I moved out west when I went to college, and But I grew up and went to high school in a town called Woodstown, New Jersey. And in Woodstown, the oldest weekly PRCA rodeo in the country is there. It's called Cowtown Rodeo. And so 018 Cowtown was the most famous and decorated and greatest bull that ever came from there. And when I got in the buck and bull business, I wanted an opportunity to own some of his progeny somehow. And so we got lucky and was able to buy Velvet Jacket. Like I said, his mother went back to Cowtown, and we raised a number of good bulls out of him. Matter of fact, we've got a bull that we raised called Tequila Worm that's at the NFR right now in Vegas. And he was sired by Velvet Jacket. And then actually his mother is a daughter of Biker Bob's mother. So there, wow. There's those cow families, you know, yeah. coming into play. Mm. So, but we've had a number of others, you know, that went to the NFR, a couple others that went to the NFR, and we've had a couple others that have made the PBR. But to answer your question, yeah, Biker Bob is the standout, and been real proud of him.
Do you think that the future of the industry is owning shares in bulls, or like for you personally, maybe is the future to retain ownership on a bull like a Biker Bob and even a percentage of it? Just
yes, I think so.
Is that has that always happened, or is it happening more now than it used to?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that absolutely, but I would imagine that. Again, with the value of these bulls going up and the earning potential going up, I would imagine that people's, breeders or whomever owns a bull, interest in retaining some sort of interest, even if it's a real fractional, you know, just seems natural that would increase, right?
Right.
I know that we intend to, we're going to start holding back, an interest in some of our bulls as we go forward. And we haven't historically. I mean, we've done some partnerships and different creative things here and there, but mostly we've sold our bulls outright. And I look to retain some ownership, in future years.
Very good. Well, for the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/223, I'm going to try and track down a couple of videos of Biker Bob and maybe some of the other bulls that you mentioned and put them in the show notes page so people can go check those out. But would there be a way that people that wanted to get involved or wanted to know more about the industry or whatever, maybe you wanted to invest in one of your bulls, could get a hold of you somewhere we could send them to get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. We do have a Facebook page, Ride Buck and Bulls. Facebook. And then you could also reach me by email, mcbridebulls@gmail.com. And I'm working on a website right now. It'll be McBride or mcbridebulls.com. And that's in the works. And I hope to have it up early this next year, like first quarter, January, February. So that'd be again, mcbridebulls.com. And yeah, or you could look at, if you would search American Bucking Bull, you'll find the ABBI's website, and you can learn about the industry and a little bit there and learn about the registry.
All right, very good.
Get some information there.
Yeah, well, we'll have links to all that at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/223. If there is anything else too major, Bob, I appreciate your generosity with your time today.
Oh, I enjoyed it. My pleasure. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to share something I love with your audience. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, your love for it is evident. It was good. It was very good. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It changes everything. So says Indiana corn grower Nathan Davis about innovative Xyway LFR fungicide from FMC. Xyway brand fungicides are the first and only at-plant corn fungicides to provide unprecedented season-long inside-out foliar disease protection. Discover more grower and retailer success stories at xyway.ag.fmc.com. Always read and follow all label directions.
really looking forward to next week on the Working Cows podcast. I had received some feedback from a previous episode about 30 by 30, and I always am willing to entertain other guests and other people to get a different perspective. And so a couple of people reached out to me and had some strong feelings about that episode on 30 by 30. And I said, well, if you've got somebody in mind that would be willing to talk to me about, the other side of that equation, pass their name along. And one of them did. And I sat down and talked with Eric Glenn. Eric is with the Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust. And we talked to him about conservation easements and some of those things. So excited to share that episode with you again real soon for another episode of the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.